Welcome to another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. I'm Yvonne Booz. This podcast is an extension of the weekly Poetically Yours segment. This month's featured artist is King Musa. Brian Harrington is a poet, rapper, and visual artist. His professional name is King Musa. He went to jail when he was a minor. In this episode, he talks about life before and after his conviction and how he's using his story to help others. The conversation starts with him explaining his stage name.
Tell me about that, the Musa. Where'd that come from?
Okay, so Musa is, the start of the first argument that I was introduced to. My mother and my grandmother was arguing about my name. And so she wanted my name to be Musa, and my mom just wanted to give me my father's name. And that was the discord at that moment. I think my mom, of course, I'm her child, so she wanted, but Musa stuck as the family name. Everybody called me Musa since birth, actually. So so it's been that since. I've actually come to find out its origin is way more powerful than I had known. So it's actually the referred name to Moses. It's the first name of Moses. Moses is the English perception of Musa, and I didn't know that. So that was like, yeah. So, which is a crazy thing, but yeah. So Musa is Moses in the Bible. Hebrew, you go back before the English translation of the Bible, it was Musa. So yeah.
That's cool. Did your grandma know that? Or do you know what her inspiration was for coming up with that?
Right. That's the part of it that tricks me to this day, is because I was only 3 years old when she passed away. So by the time I got curious about my name, around I was 10, 11 years old, I had no one to turn to. Everybody in the family just was like, we don't know. She called you Musa. That's your name. And I'm like, okay, cool. And so, I only found out the origin of the name in doing my research. Yeah.
Oh, it sounds powerful. Now tell me about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the west side of Rockford, Illinois.
Okay.
Yep. In and out of house to house, went from probably, I was born living in Concord, moved probably 3-4 times by the age of 10. I went to school, elementary school at Carlson Elementary School, went to West, and then we moved to Dallas for about a year or so, came back to Rockford where I went to Ellis Arts Academy. And then from there, I went to East High School, ultimately leading up to my incarceration.
Oh, cool. So Rockford. Now, can you tell me, growing up, what were your aspirations? Because I see you rap now. Before the incarceration happened, were you even dabbling into poetry and things like that? And tell me, what was your inspiration behind that?
Yeah, so I think just being a kid growing up in urban America, hip hop had great influence on us. So as a hobby, I did it, and I didn't ever do it as something I thought like, oh, I'm going to be this big artist. More so, I just did it like, you know, childhood nursery rhymes. Everybody was doing it, so I just wanted to, you know, be involved and be cool. But in that, I found that I had a little talent for real. Before I was incarcerated, basketball was my first love. Still is the thing that I love to do the most. I think my body gets more exhilaration from playing basketball than rapping. So rap came later as a preferred thing, but basketball was my thing as a child.
Well, that's funny. I remember I talked to someone, I want to say it was, I forget his name, but he was one of the house music guys who said he loved basketball and thought he's going to be a basketball player, but he ended up being producer and doing house music at that time. So you remind me of that story. Now, can you tell me, how old are you?
32.
Okay, you're 32. Now, you were 14 when you went to jail. What was your life like? Tell me, what was your life during that time before the arrest? What was going on in your life?
Around that time, life had been, it was blissful, it was fast, it was curiosity led. I think I was a child that wanted to find his place. I didn't feel like I found my tribe, if you will. You know, a lot of kids are are popular for whatever it is they might be. I was in a figuring out phase before, right before I got locked up. I was trying to hang around with people to see if I fit in this crowd, try to hang around the hoopers, see if I fit in that crowd, whatever the case may be. I just was doing a lot of things to appease the ego, to want to be accepted. I was going through that phase at 14 years old, just not knowing myself. So everything was a game of curiosity and trying things, and it wasn't a stable place. I wouldn't say like my 13, 14 years old wasn't a stable place for me. It was just a lot of figuring out.
Now I see that you went to jail. It was a gun deal. Tell me more about what you were involved in during that time.
Yeah, so at that time in Concord, again, being there just trying to figure life out, being around my cousins and hanging with the wrong crowd, to say for sure. And we end up trying to sell a gun. I say trying to because that ain't something that we did before. But unfortunately, in those projects, it's easy to get guns. And so outside of the projects, other older kids and always looking to buy guns. And so it was one of those things where an individual came and was like, "Hey, y'all know somebody that want to sell a gun?" And we like, "We do." And it wasn't my gun, and I'd had nothing to do with it initially. It was one of those things where I was like, again, trying to be something I wasn't. It was like, "Let me do it," like as if I watched enough movies to know how to do this thing. But yeah, it was a gun deal that went bad. There was no trust. I didn't know what I was doing. The person buying the gun didn't know what they were doing. Unfortunately, accidental shooting happened where he lost his life. So yeah, upon that, turned myself in, told the police what happened, and in their mind it's like, no, because the person who lost his life was a white kid. He was white 19-year-old kid. And I firmly believe now, knowing what I know about my whole entire case, that they needed somebody to be responsible for this white kid passing away, and they wanted to narrative to be what it was. Like, "Oh no, y'all tried to rob him, y'all killed him." And that's the narrative that they pushed. That's the narrative that they treated me like, this 14-year-old kid. I'm going against the state at that point, not knowing nothing about the law, never been incarcerated at that point. But I was up against that narrative, and ultimately end up copping out to 25 years out of fear of receiving life in prison.
Who did you have to help you and to guide you during this process? You were just a child.
Right. So initially, I had a public defender. She was a new public defender at the time. So she had been juvenile cases, but she hadn't had juvenile cases that dealt with adult consequences. So I was the first of her kind. She wasn't prepared to represent me in the court. Not no blame to her, but blame to the system for, compounding her with case after case after case, where she can go into there and just be like popcorn, or what is the where's like factory like responses, where she was able to get away with factory like responses to these other cases. But with mine, it took special consideration, special knowledge on how to approach it. Safe to say, I went up against the judge, I mean the state, ill-equipped. She didn't know. End up after my case, she ended up telling me like, well, telling the family member that she wasn't ready, and she ended up retiring because of that early. Yeah, because of the fact that she was like, "Yeah, I can't do this. Like, I can't represent kids, not to the best of my ability." And then they end up with 25 years in prison. This was her takeaway from the situation. Yeah, so that was my legal representation at the time. Probably months in, my godmother scraped up enough money to pay for me a private lawyer. I got a private lawyer by the name of Patrick Braun. He did what lawyers do. He represented me all the way up to the day of trial, where he then changed his tune. And he was like, "Oh yeah, ain't no way we beat in this case." Like literally, I went to trial, like this is no exaggeration. For a year and 9 months, he was like, giving me the angle. We gonna go in there. We just need somebody to agree with you that this is an accident, whatever, blah, blah, blah. The Friday I was going to go to trial on a Monday. That Friday he came and visited me, and his tone changed. And his tone went from optimistic to pessimistic, to saying that like, "Oh, I don't think that I fit the best chance going in here representing you. with the evidence that I have. And so he was like, yeah, they offering you 30 years. And I'm like, no, that's too much time, you know? He came back before that Monday with a plea deal of 25 years, and I had no choice but to look it over again out of fear. Not because I felt like what I did was worth 25 years in prison, but I was scared of getting life in prison. And that ultimately gave me the motivation to plead guilty against my mother's will, against her telling me not to. I still did it because it was like, I don't want to end up with life in prison. And this man telling me that if we go into this courtroom, he don't feel like he's going to represent me to the best of his ability. I don't want that person to be my lawyer no more. We didn't have no more money to provide a lawyer. So it was like, hey, this is it. And so, yeah, I pled guilty at that time.
Now, I also read somewhere there was something called the Dixon Theater Workshop. When you first went to
Yeah.
prison, where did you go?
When I first went to prison, I was in the juvenile, quote unquote, prison. And that was IYC, Joliet,
Okay.
Illinois Youth Center, Joliet,
Okay.
which no longer exists. But there was my first introduction to like prison life, but I still was around a bunch of kids. So then at 17, I was transferred to adult prison where I went to Stateville and then Menard Correctional Facility for 2 years. And then I went to a prison called Hill Correctional Center for about another 3.5 years, ultimately leading me up to Dixon, where I was able to have a little more freedom and get settled into the things that I've learned. And I started to apply, and where I can say that my productivity began as a person incarcerated, I was able to actually do things.
About how old were you when you went to the Dixon facility?
I went to Dixon, I was 22 years old.
So you were an adult by that time. So tell me about your experience with the Dixon Theater Workshop and working with those guys. It says I read that you were a co-founder of that group. Tell me more about that.
So that was a wonderful time. Not to say that I had a wonderful time in prison, but it was a wonderful moment for us and everybody else. Because as today, like this program is still going, and I haven't been incarcerated in 4 years. So the good part about it was this: there was not much things that was culturally competent in its presentation, meaning like, we had events, but if you weren't a Muslim or you weren't a Christian, those events didn't appease you. So for people who wanted entertainment or wanted song and worship and wanted, those type of entertainment aspects weren't available to you if you weren't a Christian or if you weren't a Muslim. Those two denominations were always receiving events like at Christmas time, like right now, I'm pretty sure it's some choir going in there singing to individuals, like those things were beneficial, but also we wanted to appease the rest of the population that, necessarily not religious. And anywho, so our goal though was in February of 2018, we wanted to do a spoken word event where we wanted to just have poets come up there and just rap or do spoken word. And the warden had denied us, and she was like, "Nah, that ain't something that I'm doing in my prison. Like, y'all not finna be rapping in my prison." And so, God happened. I'm gonna tell you what happened. So there was this CO who used to always talk to at the workplace. I was working at the time in a dietary, like in a life, I mean, in a diet in a cafeteria at this time. And while we were planning this as an idea, the CO was like, "Man, if I was in charge in any way, I would let y'all do that. That sound dope." God ended up turning this person into the chaplain, which is the chaplain is head over the building called 118, where the auditorium is at, where all of this equipment and stuff is at. And so he was like, "Look, y'all just come over here. I'll write y'all a pass. Y'all could come over here. Y'all could practice. Right now, we could just do it just for the sake of doing something, and y'all could get out y'all cell." Which was great because as we were doing it, more COs started to hear about it and they coming over there and they listening to us. Long story short, it got back to the warden. But the warden was like, "Okay, how is this happening? Who authorized this?" Set the guy down and he did a pitch. And so he's like, "Listen, I need y'all to rewrite that proposal, take rap out, say that y'all doing spoken word, and say that y'all are doing theater stuff. Like, we'll be doing theater plays. And I'm like, okay, nobody knows how to do theater plays, but we'll write it up. So wrote the proposal up and she approved it. And upon her approving it, we had a pilot. The pilot was the February event, and it happened, and we blew everybody away. And blowing everybody away, she was like, we need more of that stuff. And she was like, we just need more theater stuff, like act. So we started teaching each other how to write plays, and became playwrights, and started acting out these plays. And I think it was unique for me, the way I explain it now, looking back, is like, when people, the opportunity felt like this. If I give you a math problem, 9 out of 10, most people will grab a pencil and a paper and they write it out and they figure it out through formula. They say, okay, I got 97 times 7, whatever. And they write this out. This paper and this writing gives them an opportunity to sit with the problem and solve the problem. The way that I viewed the way we were doing these plays were the same thing. The individuals were writing this problem from a certain place. We writing this from a traumatic place, of a place of wish too. Like, I wish my story went like this. What can I have done different in my story? What are those moments where that changed me? What can I insert in here that would change my story? And so, in us doing that, individuals coming over there watching it was actually learning. They're learning, like, oh, that can happen. Like, oh, men, they started to know that men could cry. Men could have emotion, because a lot of times we don't think, like, coming up, unfortunately, like, for real, like, it's toxic thing that men aren't supposed to cry. We're not supposed to have certain emotions. And so, like, kids start to develop this notion in their head that they gotta be tough. And when they having these feelings, they almost having a battle with themselves, rather than just feeling sad and crying. They feel sad, then tell themselves they're not supposed to feel that. That in turn sits in them and becomes rage. It becomes frustration. It becomes irritation and all these things that it didn't have to be. But since they told me I couldn't get it out through my eyes, I got to get it out through my fists or through. And so introducing this writing, people were like, oh, you can sit with your thoughts. You can figure it out. Like, you can learn, you could talk to people. And so these are the type of things. Like, we were having kids, like, we're having people in a play talk to chaplains, having people in a play talk to their wife about how they feeling about, and then the wife giving them, feedback. And it's just a different, it was a different solution to what they were used to. And so we use these as teaching moments. And so, I got released in 2020. And the program ended up becoming a program where they actually can get good time credits from participating in this program. And now it's in two prisons, and we're trying to get it into more prisons. So that's the wonderful thing about it.
Why were you released early?
Why was I released early? A short version is that I had filed a clemency petition, and clemency at the time was a shot in the dark, meaning that nobody received it. Like, I never knew a soul that received clemency from being incarcerated, especially with a crime or incident of this severity. So I did a clemency in 2019, where I filed it myself. Like, I just was, everything I was doing it myself, which was a good and bad thing. It was bad because I didn't really have as much legal knowledge as I thought I did. It was good because I learned by trial and error, and was showing just my passion for actually returning home. But in 2019, I filed a petition. I had a hearing. Yeah, I had a hearing later that year. And then in 2020, when COVID hit, this is why I came home, was the governor kept getting on the news talking about releasing some of the pressure of the individuals dying while in prison. And that was important because they couldn't do 6 feet distancing in nursing homes or prisons or asylums and stuff, like, where people were closed in. And so people were dying faster. And you had individuals dying who only had like 6 months left. Not to put any worth on a person who has 20 years versus somebody who has 6 months. But the issue with that was that IDOC started to face a lot of lawsuits for not being able to protect these individuals. And these individuals, not even, why are they there? They got 6 months left, and this crisis has hit America, and y'all still having them do time that ultimately becoming a death sentence. So he was being faced with a lot of pressure to release individuals. So his cabinet ended up coming up with their own campaign where they were like, okay, let's release low-level offenders, and then also let's reach out to other orgs that had avenues to like people who were elderly or who were sick. I didn't necessarily fit that paradigm of elderly and sick, but there was this organization called Uptown People Law Center who was a part of these orgs that they trusted. And I reached out to them by way of hearing about them. And my homie reached out to them. And literally, the guy, the executive director of the organization, put my case in front of the governor. He read it and they felt I was a good fit. And I was home 3 days after that call. So,
Oh,
yeah.
that's wonderful.
Yep. April
Now,
8th, 2020 is when I found out I was coming home.
oh, that's wonderful. That's right around the time, like a month after we were on lockdown. So you come out and
Yeah.
you still can't go anywhere. How was
For
that? Now you get out of
real.
prison. What was life like? I've talked to some other people who spent some time in prison, and some of the things they say that they deal with is finding a job or finding a place to stay because, sometimes landlords are biased because you've been to jail or even jobs, they'll hire you and then do a background check and say, no, you know what, we changed our mind, or they'll come up with some other excuse. What was it like back then, especially during the height of the pandemic, getting out?
Getting out for me, first I'm gonna speak for everybody. I'm gonna speak for the universal things I did face, and then I'll speak on the personal things. The universal things like housing and jobs and having to register as a violent offender, that was hard. Obviously, coming home from prison and then being able, now you got a whole another new stigma that you have on your back, and so employers not necessarily want to take a risk on a guy who don't have any work experience. He's been going since he's 14 years old, and he's up against a guy who might have a GED or whatever, but hasn't been incarcerated. They're going to pick the person that offer trust in the way that society views people coming home from prison. But yeah, like employment and housing is a thing that's becoming harder and harder for individuals coming home, especially us who have to register. And I don't have to register for like sex crime or nothing. I got to register for being a violent offender, which is still something that they got to look up. So it was kind of hard for me figuring that whole thing out, even being I got locked up again because I didn't know the rules to registering. So when I did get my home, I moved. When I moved, I alerted my parole officer. He didn't even know that I was supposed to also alert the Rockford Rockford Police Department. Also, and so that's kind of saved me from when I did get locked up. The blame went on to him because I followed the directions he told me to get. But then they ultimately put him off of my case. But yeah, like it was that easy. I was back incarcerated
How
off of
long
a technicality. It was it
were
happened.
you
It
incarcerated?
was like 3 days. It was like three
Okay.
days. I was in the county. It got figured out. It got figured out. But that's how fast it happens. Like he shows up at my house one day and he's like, "Hey, my supervisor's on my butt, man. He needs you to go down to the Rockford Police Department and register your house." I'm like, "All right, cool." He's like, "Yeah, it should be no biggie. We just need to register with them too. Like, I know you register with IDOC, but you also got to register with them." All right, cool. So I go in there and I go to register. And then all of a sudden, they like, police come in behind me telling me to cuff up. And I'm like, "What? Like, what's happening?" You know what I'm saying? They're like, "Yeah, you have 5 days to register your apartment with us. And since you do that, you got to go to jail." And so, like, yeah, those things people are being faced with constantly coming home.
Now,
For me, though,
go
yeah,
ahead.
go
Keep
ahead.
going.
Tell me. No, tell me, tell me.
I want to circle back when you were talking about the rap thing. Did you ever find out the person who didn't want you guys to do rap? But what was the problem with rap? Like, did she say?
I think her problem with rap is the people who listen to rap. And what rap is being talked about and what type of rap is being pushed to our culture, I think was her personal problem with rap because she saw rap as a certain thing and not for what it was about to be used for.
So let's talk about your album. When did that process start? And how did that help you heal?
Okay, so th 13 Summers. The thing about this was giving me an opportunity to just to get it out, to be expressive, you know, use rap as the therapy I needed it to be. Having a place for me to just, I don't know, be a beacon of hope too for individuals listening. Because what happened was, like, all of these guys that was listening to my songs on the inside was motivating for me. Because they like, I'm getting calls from all over the state, from every prison, like, bro, I just heard your song. I can't believe I'm listening to you right now. I was just talking to you, and you know, like, that aspect of it was invigorating and exciting and motivating me at that time, to just be able to be a musician and be a rapper and be acknowledged as one. I think it was an amazing time.
Tell me how you got started. Like, who did you look to help guide you through the process? You have all this talent, and I know in Rockford there are several studios and different outlets for you guys. So how did you jump into that world?
I had two. I could say the first person was locally, DJ Neil Howard. He has a legendary studio that he runs out of his basement, which has like been running for years since I was a
Oh,
child.
wow. I never heard of him. Is
Yeah,
NEIL? Is that how you spell it?
NEAL,
NE.
NEAL Howard is his
Okay.
last name.
I'll look him up.
Yeah, Neil is a he's actually like he's the staple for hip hop if ever was one in Rockford.
Oh, wow.
For sure, for sure. Him and my father too, even though I don't know him, but my father was a DJ that was super, super famous in Rockford, or known in Rockford, by the name of DJ Groove. Have you heard of him?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, so he was one of those first like DJs that pushed the culture forward in Rockford. So DJ Neil was the local connect that helped me, but then Vic Mensa
Yeah, I
is,
saw that.
Vic Mensa was pivotal in giving me space to just be an artist, and then learning from him and seeing how he operates and what it takes to even, you know, see like how much he deals with as an artist. Like, oh, this is how it looks on the back end. Okay, you know, so that was pivotal moments.
How did you connect with Vic Mensa?
Okay, so rewind to when I was incarcerated. My partner at the time, Jessica Hellsinger, she was living in Miami, Florida, right? And when I used to call her, sometimes she used to go to these spoken word things. So I called one time, not knowing she was there. She was there, but she like, hey, I'm at this poetry event, but I want you to say some of your spoken word pieces. And I said a piece, and the person who was running this spoken word happened to be a girl named Aja Monet. Aja Monet is a renowned poet. She's one of our like chosen poets as Black women. She's super dope.
You have to send me
So
her information
yeah, I will. I
so I can
will.
look her up.
Yeah, please do. Please do. Like, she's amazing. So getting to know her, she through time, she was just like, oh man, I should hook you up with my brother, which is not her real brother, but like her little brother. She's like, man, he's a rapper in Chicago. I think that y'all should be connecting because he needs to bring awareness to your case up that way. And so 2018, me and him got connected, and we built a bond over just, you know, seeing the perspectives that Black boys have to live with from his perspective and from mine, person being incarcerated, and got the, you know, the got the worst of the system, and him being somebody who has to face the stigma everywhere he go, even being famous. He like, man, bro, I deal with all of this type of stuff. So we connected on that level and we became brothers. And so I met him through that avenue. So I had called one time in 2019 to his phone. Well, another person called his phone. I was rapping on the radio from his phone. In New York, he was doing a radio interview, and I was rapping from the radio on his phone. One of the biggest hip hop radio station in the world. It was amazing, and so that helped with my change.org petition, of course. So everybody was like interested after they heard me rap. They like, oh yeah, I gotta look into this guy, and so it just helped. It helped, and that's how I met him. So upon my release, we last year we went back to New York and made that thing a 360 dream come true too. So, yeah.
So I'm going to take a moment and ask if you would like to share something with me today, whether it be poetry or rap, whatever is on your heart.
Okay. Let me think. Let me think which one. Where's a little bit of a drink? I can, let's see.
And look at you, got it up here. I always admire people who remember their
Yeah,
stuff.
definitely.
I'm not disciplined enough.
You could do it. You could do it. I think if you how I write, right? So when I'm writing, so I come up with the first line, I still write. I love to write. I love my handwriting writing. I don't know why. I love it. So when I come up with the first line and the second line, I save them to come up with the third line. So by the time we get to 16 or anywhere down there, you know it up subconsciously. Like you just, because you keep saying it over and over and over to get that next line. That's just because they say that if you say something 17 times, you remember it.
Oh wow. I know some people like record themselves like a song and then they can remember it. I
Yeah,
can
like
do
that.
it. There are certain th poems that I can't remember because I wanted to, but then I just it's discipline, it's prioritizing. One day I will make that a priority and I will get up there and be with the best of the best. But if I'm
For
not
sure.
ready, I'm not getting on the stage. I'm
Yeah,
not
that
about to
part though.
do
Make
that.
sure you're ready
All
though.
right, so let me know
I
whenever
can
you're
share.
ready.
Yeah, I'll share a quick piece. It goes drenched eyelashes, a swollen throat, rusted chain connected to the handcuff on my left wrist. Me and my mother, a mental mess. A detective walks in and he says, "Sorry, Miss Harrington, but transport is here. Please say your final goodbye." We screamed, we yelled, and we cried, all out of fear of an uncertain tomorrow. See, that night, I witnessed the grief from my mother never before seen. And I was just 14. I began to play a game with the devil of confusion. That's DOC. And by the time I came to and realized that I was losing, I was already lost. 17 sitting in Menard, a maximum security prison at the bottom of Illinois. And it was so hot there. I mean, so hot that the walls were sweating, yet I had to learn how to sleep through the most chilling noise. Nightmares, screechy shrills you should never hear as a boy. An empty soul. So what my mom did was send pictures and attempts to fill in that void. But seeing good times could sometimes be like what I can imagine it would be like living in hell, hallucinating that you hear a sickling noise.
Oh, that was amazing. You are very gifted. I love that line about the sweaty walls and the chilling sounds. That is amazing. So I want to take a moment because I know it's coming up to 1 o'clock and I don't want to keep you too long, and talk about the work you're doing in the community. And I met you at one of the, I believe it was one of the
The
cultural
art.
planning events. Talk to me how you got mixed up with the community and the art scene and all of that. And then I'm going to ask you one more thing before we wrap this up. So
Okay,
talk about
cool.
that.
Yes, because I am an artist in the same way that I, built my relationship with writing. I built my relationship with drawing on the inside. And it was one of my vehicles as well. It was just as powerful as a vehicle to reach the masses as I did spoken word. Now I'm a, hold on, I got
Take your
something for
time.
you. I got something for you. Blur my background off. Is
Okay. Yeah.
that off?
Oh my God, you did that?
I'm doing that right now. I'm almost
Oh
done. So
wow.
you get an exclusive footage.
That is nice. So how long have you been drawing?
So I've been drawing since about I've been drawing as a decision since about 2012. And that means that I made a decision to try to learn it. And I started through trial and error and just got better
That
reading
looks like
books
you were
about
born with
it.
it. Like you just could do it. That's amazing. That's inspirational.
I'm actually, I mean, that's one of the latest, like I'm getting better. Like that's me getting even better. Like,
Now, who
yeah.
is that a particular person? I can't recognize him, so tell
So
me.
that's Virgil Abloh.
Okay.
Have you heard of him?
No, I haven't.
So
You know what? I
he's
have.
from Rockford.
Okay. Yeah, that's the fashion designer. Okay, got it, got it.
Which is a big inspiration for me for a lot of reasons. I think primarily I identify with the fact that I know, because a lot of times unfortunately, our local artists, people that do great things that our community don't necessarily recognize, they get in their head and they be like, oh, I can't even convince my brother to listen to my music, or I can't even convince my neighbors to listen to my music. So sometimes that stops individuals in their tracks. The reason why I admire him so much, because he became the most renowned urban designer in the history of the world, and he's from little old Rockford, Illinois. And for me, that's more affirmation that you could find your tribe outside of your city you was born in. That doesn't necessarily dictate where you're gonna go, you know. And so, anywho, that's the picture I'm doing. But
Oh.
I got involved with, actually, because of that moment at the cultural plant, what I ended up doing was getting on a board that made me want to do more in my community. And I was like, man, I gotta. And something happened in Auburn High School where it was a big fight recently. And I'm like, man, I gotta go in there. And I tried to go in there and talk to the kids. And I was met with red tape because of my background. That didn't stop me. So I went outside of the community and I was like telling Illinois Humanities, which I'm part of their board, about Rockford. And I'm like, man, we need some money. And so they awarded me $2,500 to do an event. And I paid all of them artists that day that performed from the ages of 12 to 9, to, no, from the ages of 12 to 24, actually. I ended up extending it because people showed up and they wanted to perform, paid all of the individuals. And so I'm involved in the community with art because the two times I tried to, I was met with red tape. Like I tried to go in Washington Park. There was a job opportunity open through the park district, no, through 205. It was after school art program. And the lady who ran it at the time, Laura Gomel from 317 Collective, she's like, hey, your old community center, they got to open it. So she was like, I'm gonna let you come in and teach the class. I came in, I taught the class. Man, it was great. She was like, man, I've never got all of them kids to do art at one time before. Like, that was crazy. So the people who ran the center was like, we need you. And so they talking to me and they was like, how about your background? And I was like, yeah, I've been incarcerated from 14 to 27. I was like, well, that's gonna stop you. So I'm like, damn, here it is, opportunity that I can have a job to teach the youth, and I can't do it because of my background. I wanted to go into Auburn, but I couldn't because of my background. So I'm just like, okay, let me just go outside of the community and get help. And that's where that event came about. And now that's why I met with it, with doing art with the community, because I believe in the power of art. I believe in the power of community. And so, like, if I got to use my own money, we're gonna continue to make impact. We're gonna continue to teach people, and the artist is gonna be the way. So, yeah,
What
that's
about
what
the
I'm doing
future of
now.
your music in that world? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so honestly, I'm meshing everything together because it's this thing where that's why I call myself an artivist. If you think that word, hip hop artivist, because I don't want to just be a rapper. I don't want to just be an actor. I don't want to just be an artist. I want to be able to do me and express myself through these vehicles. And so, like, coming up in January, the Mud Theater Project, the Dixon Theater writing team has evolved to the Mud Theater Project. It's the same individuals. We're putting on our first big show performance next month in Chicago, January 16th. And so this is where I get a chance to do my rapping, and I do my acting, you know, coming together. So after that, I'm also scheduled to do a project with the Coalition to End Permanent Punishment.
Yep.
They are producing a mixtape that I'm going to be featured on and be the executive director of too. So yeah, so I'm just excited. I'm excited for where hip hop is going this next year, coming year in my personal life, for sure.
That's good information. I didn't do a story on that particular organization, but I interviewed Shamaya. I think her name is Shamaya.
Shamir Love.
Shamir Love. I did a story. I was in tears talking to her, Shamir Love, and she was telling me about that. So, and I want to ask you a question about the boy that lost his life. How is his family and loved ones reacting to you? Are there any
That day, remember the day I came home, I was telling you about a lot of the comments and stuff. Some of the comments, not most of them, some of the comments were from his friends, and it was one relative who actually reached out to me and was like, we know what happened. We understand that, you know, the narrative got changed and switched, and we just want you to know that we see you. We know exactly what took place. We're not angry like we once were, you know. So hearing it from his family that they, you know the more the truth of the story than what was being led people to believe, that gave me some sense of solace and solace in the situation rather. And yeah, hopefully in the future, if God be it that we, you know, meet or I can help with something, you know, because life ain't all about retribution, you know. I think that it's about moving forward and recognizing I don't want another Musa to have to happen. I don't want another person to lose their life to some senseless crime either, you know. So yeah, I'm at that point in my life where I just like I want to better the community, so I'm doing it. I'm not, you know, I don't want to better. I'm bettering the community. And I'm going to get met with resistance, and sometimes I'm going to get assistance. So,
That's wonderful. Now, you talk about how it's hard to get certain jobs that you're clearly qualified for. How has it been as far as making a living? Have you been able to live off your art and your music and things like that?
yeah, and I can say like I feel blessed to be able to, because I know a lot of times people aren't able to make that connection between monetizing off of art and being able to monetize off of rap. And that's been the most brilliant thing in my life, I think, is being able to do my God-given talents and get paid for it. I do a traveling band in Chicago where we mix blues, jazz, flamenco, tap, and rap, and we put on these shows. Yes, yeah, it's amazing. Like it's something totally different. Every time people see it, they like, man, this is the best show. I had a woman that was 70 years old last a couple weeks ago at a show, literally tell me that was the most amazing thing she's ever seen in her life.
Where are
And
these
she's
shows?
70.
Where are you guys doing these shows?
We're doing them in all theaters in Chicago, different auditoriums, parks. We've done them probably 15 installments of the show, 15 to
Oh,
20.
where can I find information about that?
Clenard Dance, CL. I'll tell you when you're ready.
I'm ready. I'm writing right
Okay.
now.
CLINARD dance.
Okay.
Yep. Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. It's definitely it's entertaining, it's informational. We let people know all these forms. Like a lot of people don't know flamenco, even though it's a Spanish, it came from black slaves though. Like the form of dance that came from slaves. Nobody knows that. You know what I'm saying? So we get an opportunity to teach people about Afro Venezuelan dance and how the dance that they do today was from slaves. And nobody know that. You know what I'm saying? But like it's one of those things I like to explain it. I know we ain't got much time, but I think that God displays his or her, the source displays their strength in the times where the people are oppressed. So you see in these situations where people were forced to work on a railroad, where they like, oh, you know what? We're gonna turn it to an opportunity to make some Negro spirituals. We're gonna make some songs. You know what I'm saying? We're gonna create blues out of this. You know what I'm saying? Oh, we need a way to talk. We're gonna create rap out of this. You know what I'm saying? Like, we go create flamenco dance. We're gonna create all of these styles and music where it's like, yeah, y'all thought y'all were oppressing us the whole time y'all were giving birth to something great.
Oh wow.
You know?
Now, is there anything else you want to share? Like, are you doing anything else with the youth? What are your plans there? Anything else you think our listeners need to know?
For those listening, definitely, as a community, I hope that we moving towards the talk of healing our community rather than coming at it with a reactive stance of being tougher on crimes, and locking people up for longer sentences. I think that healing should be starting to look at as a crime prevention tactic. I think we need to firmly ask ourselves what are our goals, you know, and then be able to go correlate them goals to our elected officials and let them know where we at, and that we don't necessarily think that putting people in prison can better our community because it's shown that it hasn't, you know. And that's where I'm at in life. I think that if people, this is the only thing they heard out of the interview, that's what I want people to get take away from, is that we have to start looking at a different tactic in trying to treat our environments to make them a better public safety. You know what I'm saying? To make them better We can't keep reacting to incidents the way we do now, because that doesn't better the community. That's just the truth. So.
It's been a joy talking to you today, King Musa. Now, if you have another event, just be sure to keep me in the loop. And weather permits, and I can, I'll definitely come out and talk to some of the
Yeah, for
people.
sure.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. Listen to Poetically Yours every Friday during Here and Now and All Things Considered. Special thanks to the Nick Monte Trio Band for the smooth tunes you hear during this podcast. For Poetically Yours, I'm Yvonne Booz.